All right, y'all. Once again, it's the It's Going Down podcast. Thank you for listening. You know, we've been doing this podcast now for over 1 year, and we're pleased to report that we have over 50 recordings. That's more than 4 per month. Thank you for everybody that's tuned in. Thank you for everyone that sent us emails encouraging us. Thank you for everybody that's come on the program. And this week, we have another exciting show. We're putting out a couple shows this week because of the 1 year anniversary, and to say thank you for everyone that's been listening this past year and helping us grow, telling their friends about the podcast, sharing it with their coworkers, sending us emails saying, hey, you know, I love the show, but I can't hear it because I work construction and I can barely hear it through my hard hat. Thanks a lot. But this week we have a great show. Two people that were out in the streets of Berkeley. We're going to be pushing back on some of the liberal media narrative. I love saying that, by the way. And also talking about what exactly happened in the streets. You may have seen some of the media attack anti-fascist anarchists in the Black Bloc, as well as the much larger anti-racist coalition that was out in the streets of the Bay Area. But here's your chance to hear straight from the horse's mouth the people that were actually in the streets doing the hard work, being involved in the organizing from day one. We're going to get into it. We're going to critique the media. We're going to talk about what it means that they're calling for gang labels and everything like that. We're going to get into all of it. Thanks a lot. Let's get into it. Okay, we're joined here today with Conrad. Conrad is a longtime Bay Area resident and organizer, been around a while, been around the block a few times. We're going to be talking about what happened this weekend. There's been a lot of dust up, everything that went down, both in terms of people viewing this as a huge success. You know, thousands and thousands of people came out. Both alt-right rallies were canceled in various capacities. Also, the media is having a field day with denouncing quote-unquote Antifa. The mayor of Berkeley, who has spent months receiving death threats from the alt-right, is now saying that he wants to classify Antifa as a gang. We're going to get into all of it. So real quick, Conrad, would you say that the actions this weekend were successful? And if so, why?
Hey, thanks for having me on. Were they successful? Absolutely. Objectives achieved. The objectives were basically to shut down these rallies. The objectives were basically to build a much broader coalition within the local Bay Area scene, which has suffered a lot of fractures and basically unprincipled behavior in the past, or balkanization, where people basically operate in very limited spheres and don't really work across the slightest of political differences. So absolutely, it was a success. Each event was shut down nearly in its entirety. The right that showed up is fractured and finger pointing, and important messages were sent, you know, to every sector of the hard right that's been mobilizing. Each one received a very distinct message about the Bay Area and about the opposition they're facing.
Okay, well, Patriot Prayer went to a great distance to portray themselves as victims, and this is something that continuously happens on, you know, in the alt-right. You know, we saw Richard Spencer doing a lot of this post-Charlottesville. You know, the police were very mean to us, the city didn't give us the right permit, blah, blah, blah. What would you say to this kind of characterization of victimhood on their end?
It's pretty essential to the whole position and to the dynamics at work. Not only like psychologically, but historically. And of course, they're going to portray themselves as victims. What other option did they have after this weekend? Loser or deluded or... But it basically stems from the basic two major psychological foundations of these white nationalists. That one of them is, a posture of heroicism, of ascendancy, of natural entitlement to the earth and supremacy over all others, of inequality. The other simultaneous and complementary and contradictory psychological stance is that of victim, of white genocide, of persecution, of fighting back against, oppression. And these are simultaneous positions held by them. It's basically a textbook case in a psychological dissonance and reaction. And they never really, and as a side note, the complementary explanation as that they forward, that they basically utilize to like reconcile these two completely contradictory positions. Because I mean, otherwise, what is the measure of your supremacy and natural ability if you're constantly a victim? You know, they're both, they're, when you basically play each of these positions out, they're both, they're at odds. So what explains this conflict? It's anti-Semitism or conspiracism, the mysterious third hand of betrayal that basically defeats them.
Right.
This is how anti-Semitism and these conspiracies basically are also integral to this psychologically dissonant position. They're the graspings of a very bewildered, violent, reactionary position.
Well, that kind of leads us into our next question. Patriot Prayer also complained a lot about the coming together. You know, you spoke of conspiratorial forces, but the coming together of DNC hacks like Pelosi and Black Lives Matter and Antifa. I mean, this is what we heard a lot about in Charlottesville as well. Jason Kessler gave a lot of talk to the fact that the police in the city were working with anti-fascists and clergy and counter-protesters. Meanwhile, they were working very closely with the police for weeks. What do you think about these conspiracy theories, and what does this say again about them?
Well, on the face of it, they're utterly absurd. Because DNC forces are completely opposed to BLM and Antifa. It's almost a grab bag of cartoonish figures that are on their like landscape that they basically piece together to construct, you know, a rationale, to construct a worldview. And like the slightest attention to reality to even the mainstream press completely contradicts it. But that's kind of beside the point. Because conspiracism, that namely that pattern of reaction and explanation of the world, is basically to look for cartoonish villains and behind the scenes decision making affecting the world, basically an anti-systemic analysis, is common to the left and the right. And it's pathetic. It's pathetic, but it's completely understandable, because these people basically have to construct this enemy in this fashion because they have nothing else. Because conspiracism, among all the other like psychological engines that drive it, and the kind of mass thinking that drives it, and in terms of like the media, the internet nature of media also driving it in these modern era, conspiracism thrives on what's called an explanatory gap. Basically, you have no better explanation to basically model the world. You have no, your worldview and your model is insufficient, and so you apply like the childish tools that you've been basically socialized with. Basically, Americans are taught a history that revolves around individuals and cartoons and myths. These are the only intellectual and like analytical tools people have. Then they basically apply this to a bewildering worldview to basically construct a narrative that will yet again like rein all the complexities of their situation back within grasp, and then basically boil it down to a ridiculous cartoon. And this is a cartoon that they've offered. It's just that it's incredibly pathetic. It's also interesting, though, that one of the strengths of the hard right has been their creation of an alternate media. Mm-hmm. Of an alternate culture, except that they're also suffering right now from the backside of that, the downside of that, mm-hmm. in that they've created a massive echo chamber. So they have no grasp or ability to advance their analysis or their strategic thinking. Like every step forward they take in developing their own media and ability to communicate with in their own movement also reinforces the bubble and the echo chamber, and they hamper their own ability to analyze and recognize conditions on the ground. This is also a failing within the left. Let's just recognize that. And also distinctly a failure within anarchist subculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's also interesting, too, that a lot of these people have such like a far social media reach, but also we're not seeing a lot of people come out to support them. Like, for instance, you know, in Boston, you know, some of the people that were out there to, quote unquote, speak after Charlottesville had like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Twitter followers. And that magically did not translate into people on the ground.
Right. Well, they've recognized this for a long time. And this is a stated objective of the Sacramento mobilization last year, to take it from online to the streets. Mm-hmm. And they are discovering it is incredibly easy to get Twitter followers, incredibly hard to basically translate this, you know, into the real world, into daily lives, into physical presence, because it's a completely different skill set. And they're also basically suffer from the malaise of everyone else within a spectacular society, of atomization, mm-hmm. of inability, like a lack of a social muscle, mm-hmm. a complete destruction of community. Mm-hmm. And they are spectacularly well ill prepared to take on those tasks of rebuilding that. Mm-hmm. Which is why these actions largely pivot around viral figures, around they're replicating essentially virality on the street, which is also a massive weakness. As like, we sent Joey Gibson packing. These figures are discredited.
Right.
The anchors to these physical actions are now all finger pointing at each other. The circular firing squad is in full effect. You know, so once you understand that their physical organization, like on the street and in physical space, mirrors that of the online world, it becomes a lot more, you know, understandable.
Right. Well, just to go off on a little bit of a tangent, you brought up the problem of an echo chamber either on the left or within anarchism. I mean, do you have any ideas as far as how to combat that, especially at a time when I think a lot of people are looking at, you know, the ascension of alt-right media and saying like, wow, you know, how would we get to that point? Or is that maybe the wrong question? I'm just curious your thoughts.
Many people on the left are still tied to this idea of a civil society, that society exists, that it's not a fundamental antagonism and a contest of force. So no matter what their lip service, they're still intellectually and behaviorally, just in terms of daily patterns, tied to tuning in to mainstream news sources. And I don't know, it's a difficult question. I don't have a simple answer. I mean, I'm still sifting through a lot of it myself, and also my various circles and organizing projects are, you know, always grappling with this question. And there are some real difficulties with, you know, if you want to reference Gramsci about creating a cultural hegemony, basically a dual power in terms of, in cultural terms. Mm-hmm. And we have to be very real about what those obstacles are. And that one, you can build a subculture that's aligned with institutional values very easily, which is how we see like the far right, like, you know, metastasize. They're basically an extension of social order, maybe more virulent and more candid form, but they receive no real opposition. Some of that's like being pulled back now with their DNS domains being yanked, with they're getting trolled back. I mean, but largely they basically had an easy, smooth road ahead of them. Mm-hmm. Forces that are counter to the social order face a much heavier and steeper, like, you know, hill to climb. It's a very rocky road in front of it with obstacles and enemies. One being just resources, just the ability to do it. As we're worked more and more, as precarity and austerity, like, take even more of a hold, basically targeted and impoverished, marginalized communities have known this forever, that one of the principal blocks to them forming and maintaining their own culture and space and autonomous space. You know, for all the anarchist trumpeting of autonomous zones and squats and exarchia, like Greenville, you know, Oklahoma was, and Rosewood, they were autonomous communities. They had to face direct military attack, but also in terms of maintaining the culture is the material, like, hurdle. Basically having the wherewithal to fund and the time to create and maintain these things. Not to mention the physical space in order to which recreate community. You know, it's like an internal diaspora. that's continually under attack. You know, colonization, like once, you know, the settlers reached the Western Shore, displacement and the removal and churn of native and subject populations became of internal displacement and internal diaspora. I mean, I think it's very hard under those conditions in order to create autonomous culture.
Well, we brought up the media. What do you think the goal right now of either the center, the right, even the liberal or even left media is in attacking autonomous social movements or various actors? You know, right now, obviously it's Antifa, but also it could be the Black Bloc or anarchists or Black Lives Matter, No Dapple protesters. It doesn't really seem to matter. It's always, you know, there's always kind of a target in this direction. But broadly speaking, right now, with what you're seeing, what do you think the goal is of the media to kind of, push these attacks?
I think it's a mass phenomenon. We can't really speak of the media and a discrete goal as though there were a single one or a single hand at work. I think it's interesting that right now it seems to have shifted. Things are changing incredibly rapidly, so I'm also grappling with analyzing, understanding what's going on. But the media shift has been, very distinct and pronounced from before Charlottesville, at Charlottesville, post-Charlottesville, and now after Berkeley, that while it's very pronounced and distinct, these shifts, when the love affair that briefly happened after Charlottesville,
right,
and then there was this lull, and then even during the Berkeley action, you could see there's always this window where a couple reports come out in mainstream media that seem almost accurate,
right?
Even Berkeley side, a notorious reactionary NIMBY kind of paper within Berkeley, published one of the more even-handed reports immediately. As the same did KTDU when they were filming live, but you give it half an hour, an hour, after the action, it's the editorial hand takes control.
Exactly.
You know, then it all starts to shift. They're very much animals of the wind. They put their finger to the wind, and it's not as though they even receive marching orders from a singular source, but there's a very machined and honed sense developed over decades now of basically catering to a very sensationalistic impulse, but also this notion of the Overton window, what's normalized. They basically, if it's within this window of normal, it gets a certain treatment. If something steps outside of it, there's a moment of fascination or of novelty or of peddling, a certain insider view. The amount of requests that we've had from media to embed with Antifa or embed with organizers, and now people are even sniffing around from the more mainstream moderate left, asking what's your coordination inside? There's this fascination because of novelty, because I'm seeing them as some zoo animal. It's these weird kind of circus atmosphere where they basically treat people as sideshows.
Right.
Then it becomes a very distinct ideological thrust. There's a certain maintenance that needs to be done. I think that's when the editors come into control much more than the individual reporters.
Mm-hmm.
And now I would characterize this current moment as not just an attack on Antifa or anarchists or Black Bloc. It's an attack upon the networks and relationships that were built,
mm-hmm,
using Antifa as a wedge in order to blow this out of the water.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, just attacking those kind of more, I don't know, visible elements that really kind of speak to what they're scared about, which is, an autonomous kind of force.
But I also want to take a moment to recognize, whatever pressure or, guess what? Being classified as a gang, if you're Antifa, welcome to the world of being black and brown.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's only a speculation at this point. To basically wake up in this country as non-white or as any number of these, oppressed and marginalized identities, those sectors of the population, that is to exist with a death warrant on your head that can be enacted at any time during your life. And all these forces of the media will be right there with the rationalization while the cops are right there with the bullet.
Right.
Be real about this attack. It is minor compared. The fact that we had black faces like in the press conference from the movement organizers, black organizers standing up and telling the establishment basically to fuck off, we apologize for nothing, is an immense act of bravery.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but I think that's a really good point that you brought up about there was a moment where people were basically just reporting the facts, and then, you know, the editorial kind of push came in. And really, like, that was the same with Charlottesville. If you look back, like, at, for instance, Slate, you know, some of the best things that were published was something on Slate that was literally had nothing to do with what people from Slate thought. It was just clergy and other people reporting from on the ground and just saying what happened. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's the first thing to get buried. And if you look back again on at, you know, quote unquote Berkeley, you know, so there's only a few voices that are really, you know, talking about not only what happened, but also just, you know, this was a huge, you know, positive thing that brought thousands of people together, had all these different sectors activated. But again, that's all buried now with the amount of editorials and attacks that have come out.
Well, it's buried if you're out of town.
Sure.
Inside town, like, there, like, the number of voices from outside, like, radical circles that are basically proclaiming this as a watershed moment of, like, unity that was inspiring, and also, like, staying true to their promises and their pledges of solidarity first, of not throwing people under the bus, of collaboration is inspiring, and it's basically overwhelming. And the number of voices coming out with their own testimonials as to what happened is intense. It's massive, and I think therein lies the lesson and the real value here. It's like, what did we expect? Like, did we expect, you know, Cron 4 or Slate or all these other things?
Right.
To basically suddenly become like belie their own nature and funding and character and ideological commitments to suddenly become a movement source? Mm-hmm. Like, absolutely not. It's just kind of notable in the stark contrast between actual physical events, actual relationships and happenings on the ground, and the complete fabrication in these stories.
Uh-huh.
And that contrast is where like a lot of people who actually experienced like what went down are receiving a very important and stiff lesson in the agenda and role of the media. Mm-hmm. Namely that when called upon, the media's job is to basically alienate movements from their base. That is their job in terms of like the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And I think all these sources that basically play around with you know, quasi-liberal or quasi-progressive stances, whether it be Slate or, you know, BuzzFeed or all these other things, they're playing games. They're basically servicing appetites, but they're essentially corporate media at the core. Mm-hmm. We recognize them exactly for what they are. And like, this is one of these telltale moments where not only are these masses of people and all the people that they know and all their family and all their circles are basically realizing the media, this what I call a pig media, is an enemy. Like, now this is a great litmus test for who exactly is a movement media source.
Yeah, I totally agree. And also, I mean, I was thinking about this today, but it seems like, I mean, the media, I really feel like, especially the center and like what we would classify maybe liberal or definitely aligned with like the Democratic Party. I mean, I really think that they're loving this moment because they get to kind of come out as, you know, being a resource or, you know, making a stand or hashtag the resistance. And I think a lot of them are really terrified of any sort of actual physical movement.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important. I keep coming back to this insight a friend of mine had, in that that basically the time when liberals and this so-called center, the people that could basically you know, make their accommodations with capital and white supremacy and still maintain a stance of you know, being a member of civil society and being progressive, is coming to a close. It's dying. You know, it's not just polarization. It's basically basically material conditions on the ground, the state of conflict and antagonisms, the withdrawal of the wages of whiteness, are basically forcing these people into a new position. They're forcing them into a position that recognizes their worldview and their model of the world and of themselves, their very identity and the foundations of their lives, are not only bankrupt, but are no longer tenable. And then fighting this, like, urge, in fighting this reality, They will throw anybody under the bus that's necessary. It will be fought. They will not acquiesce on the, for the most part, which is why we're not surprised that, like, at a distance, without the weight of, like, the massive turnout and experience of what happened on the ground in Berkeley, why it's so easy for these people to, like, flip, you know, that they were basically cheering, you know, a month ago after, like, Charlottesville, to suddenly flip and, like, go full denunciation. Because they're basically, in a very similar way to the hard right, they're kind of desperate and reactionary and seeking a new kind of state of well-being, a new state of compromise with the state of the world. And so they will thrash. They will denounce and throw anybody under the bus that they have to in order to, like, reattain that, like, that tenable psychological position of somehow, like, making your compromise with the world and also retaining some notion of heroic status of being someone worthwhile.
Right. And also too, I think that speaks to kind of the, I don't know, the pathology, I guess, of a lot of journalists of, like, wanting to really kind of put themselves in the middle of all these things that are happening, even if, of course, they weren't there, but, you know, really putting their values and whatever they think kind of at the center and saying, like, look, actually I'm right. And you should have stayed home. And because that's what I did. But just moving on, you brought up this press conference that took place, or there's a video online of people doing a press conference the day after Sunday. Basically, the other organizers or a collection of organizers that were part of this broad anti-racist coalition did not denounce the anti-fascists. Can you just talk about this, your thoughts, why this was important, and anything else you want to add about that?
Well, it's... granted that, like, coming out against ideological and declared white nationalist is kind of a low hurdle for unity.
Right.
I mean, but it's also a gift, a blessing, in the way that basically the hard right is organizing a broad, like, oppositional, like, force for us. It basically provided the grounds for a lot of different sectors that were sometimes at odds, well, let's just say in the Bay Area, often at odds.
Right.
Thinking they didn't need each other or even needed to communicate. They didn't even need to articulate their positions in face, in person, or to each other, even if they could. Many people can't actually articulate positions because they've never been pushed to. Now that's happening. You know, this is kind of one of these moments. That's what's really of value here, is this relationships being built and these skills being built. Actually, it's not just a matter of ethical decision making or imperative that people articulate, defend, and strategize not only their own position but collectively. Like, that's a skill that has to be built. It has to be exercised. It has to be learned. It has to be developed. And it's a collective exercise, so it's a very hard thing to do. And this is, like, one of these moments when a lot of people are basically, there's a learning curve in effect. It's one of these moments when you learn, like, in a day, what would take you a year in more placid or muddier times to learn.
Right.
So the next days, it was very clear that they did not denounce. Like, and let's not recreate this false like, division between, quote, organizers and, quote, Antifa.
Right.
Antifa were organizers. All these forces, like, across the spectrum, there's no one distinct mass called Antifa. That's nonsense. You know, all the different various formations were part of these coalitions, were in these meetings. I'm not going to get into all the mechanics, simply because of security and the right to keep our strategy and internal discussions to ourselves, but they were part of the process. And the fruits of that, but they're obviously not able to basically step to the mic like other organizers, you know, could, like those folks that bravely did so in these press conferences, you know. So there's a division of labor going on. There's actually, you know, it's not, the coalitions are usually, you know, fake. They're basically a couple shot callers in typical coalitions that basically are gatekeepers or have all the social capital or a very unequal partnership. Mm-hmm. These moments with a variety of different forms aren't just coalitions. There are a variety of different collaborative spaces, you know, working. It's actual division of labor going on. There's an actual interplay and relationships being built, not just between individuals, but between sectors, between different folks from different walks with different, you know, aspirations in politics. you know. So, like, that bore fruit. We have agreements. We had points of unity. There were things that were negotiated. It took a lot of work. That was started way before Charlottesville. There people have been quietly working their asses off, eating a lot of shit in a lot of coalition spaces. That's part of the job. And it's finally bearing fruit. So that's what my thoughts are on this.
Well, speaking of the broad coalition model, do you feel like this needs to be implemented across the board, especially as more and more groups of people find themselves organizing broad demonstrations against the far right?
Nope. I mean, it's not a model.
Okay.
It's basically a state of relationship. It's basically been called into being. You know, I'm not one of the followers of this united front thinking, that kind of trot idea that we all somehow, you know, it's a substitute for building the party, that we build the united front.
Sure.
That's nonsense. I don't think it reflects reality. I don't think it's ever actually been demonstrated in history in a valid way. And I think it's an intellectual idea that really bears no fruit and shows no existence on the ground. But the coalition model, basically the skills that I mentioned before that are being basically honed and brought into being, and the relationships and kind of, what I call it, like the breaking of a certain vapor lock, you know, if you're mechanically oriented, there's a certain like vapor lock that causes an engine to cease functioning where fuel locks up in a hose. Like, but breaking that kind of this stalemate is very important. I think it's very important, especially for folks on the fringe, which includes most anarchists and any authoritarians, that they're basically being forced to articulate and represent their politics to a much wider variety of people. And this is an American, like, malaise. You know, in other parts of the world, to operate within your local political contents and represent yourself in other spaces is not some foreign, like, leap forward, you know?
Right.
It's this particular, I mean, I haven't been to any other countries because I've just heard about them in like, testimonials and what people have said who have been there. But in this, and also it's like an urban thing. Like, any authoritarians and folks that basically have come to a certain revolutionary kind of practice in their lives in rural and smaller towns, they operate within their towns. It's not a strange idea that they have to like rub elbows with other people and basically deal with them and respect them or like come to some accommodation. Like, this is predominantly some like weird urban anonymous subcultural nonsense that you can basically like form some vague notion of community through some shared allegiance to, you know, a subculture and not have to deal with anybody else.
Right.
And it's not saying that you have to be friends with everybody or collaborate with anybody or even like ditch security culture and like out yourself and to everybody under the sun. Like, hell no. But the idea that you can operate in a vacuum and like not like shoulder accountability and relationship building within a certain geography, that's utter fucking nonsense.
So a big question is, you know, with this energy strategy, relationships, however you want to define it, how can we go beyond, you know, as you put it, the low bar of the alt-right? You know, how do we continue forward post-Charlottesville?
Well, every incident and moment in a certain lens is a lesson for the next. Even if they're defeats or whatever, or even if they're fractures. I mean, the strength of this current moment is basically the fruit, like at least locally here in the Bay Area. I mean, I can really only speak to the Bay Area. And even like that, I can really only speak to the East Bay. I don't fuck with San Francisco or anywhere else or San Jose. Is that like this is the fruit of a lot of pain, suffering, hardships, and defeats.
Yeah.
You know. But if we're talking about energy and trying to like take like all the attention that it's getting or the fact, you know, basically 7,000 people were out in Berkeley, you know, and came together pretty quickly. But also, you know, like, there were, like, what, 50,000 people for, you know, fucking Women's March.
Right.
You know, which was, like, vapid and empty of most politics. But a lot of people thought it was a really valuable experience. I'm not going to take media attention and like opinion polls as, you know, and like basically wield them, you know, opportunistically to ratify some own, you know, agenda of mine, you know, or like, it's not an affirmation. It's not a vindication of our position. You know, we have to be realistic in that attention, you know, is fleeting. We live within a spectacular society that basically panders to a lot of appetites and gestures and performances. Things come and go. You know, attention and activity can be a mile wide, but an inch deep. So, I mean, while it's heartening, while I'm seeing a lot of people become activated and there's this kind of intense learning curve that's like been accelerated within a lot of different areas. And we've definitely made an impact outside, like the activist ghetto. This is now like some real power being built. It's not the typical lefty oblivion land of, you know, self-confirming nonsense. We have to be real. Like, this isn't some massive watershed event. There's not some switch that has to be flipped. You know, this is still a marathon of decades, if not centuries. You know, I mean, until I die. So I'm not thinking like the next month of the year. This has been some massive turning point. That's basically just lazy ass thinking.
Let's turn to kind of repression stuff. Nancy Pelosi has issued something condemning anti-fascist violence. Although somebody said on Twitter, Nancy Pelosi has a lower approval rating than Donald Trump. So who really gives a shit? But also the Berkeley mayor has talked about classifying Antifa as a gang. What do you think all this means? I mean, you kind of brought this up and kind of put it in a certain context, that all this stuff really isn't new, especially for, you know, the most oppressed and the most attacked segments of society. But what do you think these kind of bureaucrats kind of making these gestures means for the future?
Nothing. I mean, what do you think it would do? You know,
right,
I would be more if Nancy Pelosi expressed her support.
Right.
The co-optation was on the table. I mean, there's just always a big-ass problem, especially in this little Charlottesville moment. Like, this, I am Antifa, this we are all Antifa nonsense. Like, no, you're not. Like, no commitment, no activity, and basically every other aspect of your life is basically collaboration with a fucking violent settler colonial state. You know? So, I'm glad to have the right enemies. You know?
Right.
I mean, and also the state, Barbara Lee also, like, put out a statement denouncing, like, Antifa. You know? Mm-hmm. But what did we expect they would do? Like, they would support the development of, like, an alternative, like, dual power in the street?
Like, exactly, yeah.
You know? And, of course, they, like, pick the most vulnerable and marginalized and, like, preordained as, like, an icon for attack, which is, you know, like it's also, like, interesting that gang and now anarchist. Like, it's happened before. They've been lumped together as, like, sure. Anarchist gang. And, you know, everyone in the scene or the subculture, like, laughs at it because, oh, how so ignorant. But no, they're basically deploying what's called epistemic violence, basically defining someone out of personhood, you know, mm-hmm. like stripping them. Like, there are certain categories of human being that are within society that are designated as almost like non-persons, whether it's homeless or black or immigrant. Or even like Muslim, like there are all these various different aspects to each of these categories, but they basically deploy them in order to enact violence. They basically or ascribe all these values to these descriptors to deploy violence, like the physical and the institutional and the epistemic. They all complement each other. So like now we have a gang being like put together with you know, Antifa, and it's basically a wedge in order to basically split apart this kind of unified and like rapidly developing political moment, you know. So it's like, of course, like I welcome it, you know, because I mean, it's also actually a bigger problem because we're basically trying to like split off an autonomous like power like of resistance. We're not trying, you know. There's no future in you know, developing within some like, you know, like. We're going to be the sixth estate within civil society. We're going to affect reform. Like, no, fuck that. Fuck America. Burn it to the ground. It's like defunct. It's an enemy. Always has been. So it's like, you know, I'm glad like they're not masquerading as friends.
Right, exactly. And it was interesting too, because you know, before I saw before the demonstrations took place, I think, you know, these same people were saying like, you know, we condemn the white supremacist rally, blah blah blah. I don't know, it's very interesting. Like, just as we were talking, I saw that the ADL has put out a guide to anti-fascism for law enforcement, basically instructing them to you know, how to deal with anti-fascists. So which is a whole nother can of worms. I mean, this kind of the people that are on this whole train of like, it's about, you know, extremism, and there's extremism on both sides.
Yeah, fighting to maintain this mythical center, this kind of blind, like, relativistic position. It's basically like, hooray for the status quo, and let's strip it of all values, history, and analysis, and just, like, hold on to this. And, like, let's just say fuck the SPLC, too. Fuck the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah.
They're also in this camp. They actually fund repression, they do shitty research, and they're also, like, dominate the field of, like right wing of like analyzing the right wing,
right?
And they do a poor job of it, and they're a money beast. Mm-hmm. You know, let's give a shout out to the people that do good research, like whether it's the local Antifa crew who are basically dorks that spend 90% of their time doing research, looking on forums and reading books, and like and also like salting like white, you know, white supremacist bars and like gathering information, and then like 10% is like, you know, street action.
Right.
So give a shout out to them, and give a shout out to Political Research Associates, PRA. Hallelujah for them, man.
Yeah, the only research firm that's like, you know, we're actually creating information for social movements, and we don't give a fuck what you do with it, as opposed to the SPLC, who constantly quotes IGD and refuses to name the website that they're quoting from.
And PRA operating with what, like 3% of SPLC doesn't like also like is. Like also like offers a good model for like basically political media action, in that they basically state their position, they're clear about it, they don't like basically deploy mainstream propagandistic tropes as a self descriptor or as a justification for their work, and it's mostly volunteer labor.
It's interesting though, because I mean you can see like ADL, SPLC like kind of basically picking up these right wing positions of being against social movements that are pushing back against, you know, the far right or the auxiliary right, because in my mind their kind of position is collapsing, because their whole thing is like, you know, we document extremism, we don't want you to do anything about it, but we think the state should, you know, pass a law or something. And if there was, you know, obviously at this time in history, you know, the government is not only feeding off the far right, but actively encouraging it and getting people in the administration, which are a part of it, or, you know, kind of a circle removed. So, I mean, if there was ever a time to like make an argument that like that strategy doesn't work, it's now. And I think that they need to kind of find another way of justifying their existence.
I mean, they're part of this center that's going to throw anyone under the bus in order to retain their importance and centrality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, any closing thoughts? I mean, one of the things that I was thinking while we were talking about is like, as these kind of things break apart and as kind of people show their hand or the center kind of tries to reconstitute itself, what should we be thinking about? Is there a way to kind of like draw lines in the sand to make people kind of realize these contradictions and kind of bring them towards something else, or anything else you want to say?
Well, who's this we that we're talking about? Because I have a very uneasy relationship with, like, the anarchist subculture or Antifa. I actually don't, like, identify as Antifa.
Well, I guess by we, I mean, like, autonomous social movements and people involved in social struggles that want something outside of electoral politics but are pushing towards a different kind of world.
One, the time of the atomized, like, the whole notion of that insurrectionary notion that you can just remain atomized and just like jump into a situation that's spontaneously developed is utter nonsense. Uh-huh. It's a kind of a longer, like, it's, I don't place a big amount of faith in the organization, capital T, capital O. I don't believe in building the party or some small, like, you know, subset of that idea and calling it something else. But basically to think that you can basically develop and articulate a position, or even maintain personal security, you know, or develop any real community without a commitment to some collective entity or some collective project that's also long-term that you basically commit to. is nonsense. I mean, that is the vehicle within which you can develop. I mean, it's not the only arena, but like in this moment and the way forward is like crew up, you know, and beyond just a crew for these like days, like federate, you know, build a project, commit to something long term. I mean, there's no real accountability. Like how, I mean, people in smaller areas, like these mythical communities that people like refer to as wanting or in the past as having existed, like people had a collective identity and fate just by virtue of geography.
Right.
Like, just because you're kind of bourgeois mobility, if you have it, like it enables you this kind of individualistic, atomized identity and notion of politics, you know, that's a problem, not a virtue. Mm-hmm. You basically gotta like commit to an area and responsibility and accountability and building like something that's longer term. You know, just dying, like, you know, ending your life after being a tourist basically in every single venue you've lived in is like no way to live and no way to build anything.
Right.
And it basically, and mass as a phenomena, it basically ensures misery. It ensures misery forever. You know, everyone else, every opposition is basically acting and sharing labor and learning at an increased rate if they operate collectively.
Right.
They're at a certain force. You have to, instead of like analyzing one's actions instead of righteousness or purity or correctness or edginess, it has to be measured in other terms. Basically, in effectiveness, collectivity, and lessening your own misery in daily life. You know, none of what I do would ever be possible if I were acting alone.
Right.
None of it. Even like in all these lessons I'm trying to like relay or I'm still struggling with, these are all the fruit of collective work. You know, I'm not going to live as a victim, as some like piece of flotsam or jetsam on a tide or on a wave. You know, it's just guaranteed misery.
Yeah, we all need to be building. Joining here today with somebody that participated last weekend in the massive anti-fascist mobilizations against Patriot Prayer and whatever Kyle Chapman's group is calling itself. We're going to be talking basically play-by-play, what all went down on Saturday and Sunday, what happened. We're going to be looking at some of the things the media has been saying, seeing if that matches up with what people on the ground actually saw and experienced, and just kind of going over what happened. So we're joined here today with somebody that was there, across the weekend, and is a Bay Area anti-fascist. And do you just want to talk a little bit about in the lead up to this? I mean, what do we know about these groups, and what did people think about going into this?
Yeah. So both of these last weekend's events were planned months ago. Uh-huh. We knew that they were happening since like June. And they were just sort of riding the wave of all of these right wing free speech events. It didn't seem like they were adding anything. It never seems like these people have anything to say once they show up. They just figured out that this is the way that they can somehow advance their politics and attack the left. And so we knew this was happening. People were organizing. Joey Gibson is like, he's not a fascist. I don't think anyone thinks that he's a neo-Nazi or a fascist. But the problem with him is that he continually organizes these free speech rallies and far right rallies that invites and makes space and helps to mainstream these alt-right neo-Nazi and other fascist types. And that's the problem that people had with him, is that he would organize these things and he would let these people in and sort of capitalize on Trump's popularity and mix all these different right-wing elements together. And no matter how many times he says that these alt-right people and white supremacists are not allowed, he'd always end up standing side by side with them. So the issue was never necessarily about Joy Gibson, but about the space that he makes for people even much more further to the right than him. And the same thing goes for Amber Cummings, who organized the Berkeley No to Marxism rally, except she's closer to Kyle Chapman, who's actually much more along the lines of a white nationalist than Joy Gibson is. And they have even closer ties to some of these like white supremacists and Charlottesville kind of people.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What are the links between Unite the Right and the people that organized the action, you know, on the right side, the actions this weekend?
So, in Charlottesville, that was mostly organized publicly anyway by this guy, Jason Kessler, who's a Proud Boy, who has been getting closer and closer to a lot of these alt-right types, Richard Spencer, Nathan D'Amico, who are also involved in organizing Charlottesville. Kyle Chapman, who we've had problems with in the Bay Area since March, he's also in the Proud Boys. There's pictures of him and Jason Kessler shaking hands on the internet. Jason Kessler actually came out to Berkeley on April 27th to spend time with a lot of the people that came out here for a rally on that day. And that's a big link there. Another one is Augustus Invictus, who's like a libertarian fascist. He was
reactionary libertarian, please.
Yeah. He was supposed to be a speaker at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Mm. And he, along with Kyle Chapman, he's a leader and organizer in the Folk Fraternal Order of Alt Knights. And, he also, I think he works with Chapman on a crowdfunding site, Back the Right. So he was supposed to speak here in Berkeley on Sunday too. So there's a lot of links between what happened in Charlottesville and the people that organized that and what was happening there.
Right. And then the other link, the hard to see link is of course Baked Alaska. And he came out to several of the quote unquote free speech events in Berkeley. And he also, has spoken at Joey Gibson's events and the one Kyle Chapman has organized. And also, of course, he was at Unite the Right as well.
Right. Yeah. I guess he didn't have too good of a time there, so he didn't come out to the Bay Area last weekend. Right. But yeah, he's also someone very prominent in those circles and has close ties to all these people.
And it's funny because, you know, people have been publishing stuff for months now pointing out the connections between, you know, neo-Nazis and the alt-right and Kyle Chapman and Joy Gibson, you know, specifically about people like Baked Alaska. And people on that side have just tried to, you know, brush that stuff away.
Yeah, they definitely, it's like they change the argument. You know, they want to say they hate identity politics, but they try to use it to their advantage by saying, you know, like, oh, all of our speakers are, you know, trans or right. black or, you know, they're not white people. But that was never the argument. The problem is the space that they make for these neo-Nazis who are the biggest, you know, demographic at these rallies.
Right. Okay, well, just can you take us through Saturday? What all happened? Originally, Patriot Prayer got a permit, and then they were upset because apparently the city was saying, like, you can't have guns on the park, and there's going to be all these stipulations. So they kind of pulled out of that, and then they announced they were going to have a press conference at 2 o'clock in the middle of San Francisco, and thousands of people showed up.
I think they were looking for a fight, and they knew that they weren't going to get it at Chrissy Field. They had a lot of police protection and all kinds of precautions put in place to prevent that, but they were looking for a particular sort of scenario to go down, so they canceled at the last minute.
Why do you think that they canceled? Because most people would say, like, well, you know, there was going to be more counter-protesters, so why wouldn't you want to be, you know, surrounded by police, you know, with fences surrounding you, like, have all that protection? Like, what was their problem exactly?
I think it goes back to what happened in Charlottesville. That really changed things. The whole right-wing free speech rally tactic sort of died in Charlottesville.
'Cause that was promoted as a free speech rally as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And it because of what happened there, they got a lot of backlash from a much wider sector of the country than they had previously been used to. And what happened was they were no longer victims. They could not frame themselves as victims in these scenarios anymore. So I think that was part of the reason that they canceled. They knew that they could have their rally in Chrissy Field and everything would be fine, but for them, they were looking to reassert their position as victims. So they kind of made up this story of, like, oh, you know, like, we're scared of what might happen to us and all this, but I don't think that that was actually going to happen.
Yeah, literally makes no sense. Like, I saw they put out a video, like, they went back to San Francisco or they're coming back, and, like, I watched it for, like, a minute, and they said, San Francisco's not going to kick us out. They're not going to get rid of us. It's like, dude, they gave you a fucking permit. They wanted to have, like, the entire police force surrounding you. Like, what the like, you want the military there? Like, you want a force field? Like, what the fuck? You know, like, what are you talking about? And they did all this bullshit about how, like, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi was in bed with Black Lives Matter and Antifa and was going to kill them, and just all this stupid, like, you know, pseudo conspiracy shit. But it's just crazy. I mean, like, they got what they wanted. Like, they got a permit. They got all the police to come out. They're going to protect them. And they just totally said, no, fuck that, you know?
Yeah, and I think if they really wanted to, they probably would have even got what they wanted at the Alamo Square Park. I mean, the police were, like, immediately right on top of that at the last minute, closed the park, had tons of cops on the scene, and you know, they were ready to protect them there too.
So what actually happened? Did they have a press conference? Like, did the police kick people out of that square? Like, what all went down in that area?
I got there a little bit before the rally time that had been called for, which I think was 11, and there was already a lot of people waiting at the corner that was on the flyer. The park was totally closed off. Nobody was allowed in. But it seemed like the police were a little bit slow to figure out how exactly they wanted to respond. People got pretty close to the park, but as time went on, the police figured out that they were going to stop people from even getting that close and kind of change their strategy to, you know, if all these thousands of people are going to show up, how do we best contain them to our preferences rather than, you know, letting them do whatever they're going to do.
So did they let people from Patriot Prayer into the park, or?
I heard that they did, but I didn't see that myself. It sounded like some people got in, but I don't know for sure. It was very confusing and hard to move around there. There was like impromptu, spontaneous checkpoints everywhere and new ones every time you turned a block. There was already, you know, something different happening. Wow.
So the police were trying to like stop people's movement or just check people for weapons, or what were they trying to do?
They were mostly stopping movement. They weren't even allowing people to pass through weapons or not, like a couple blocks out of the park. So you could, if you wanted to join other protesters, you had to go to a specific intersection at some point. And
So by and large, you didn't have an idea of like how many far right people actually showed up. At least
I heard something like 75 or around there got into the park and then kind of left, but that seems hard to believe.
Right. So even in that instance, they were still basically facilitating, you know, a permitted situation in the sense that they were allowing them entrance into an area and then basically protecting them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of amazing how many resources they were willing to put in for someone who claims that they don't have free speech.
Yeah, and then turns around and blames the police in the city for like being so horrible to them. Huh. So yeah. At that point, is that when like different union contingents started to show up, or the ILWU came out? How did that all play out?
Yeah, a lot of different groups started showing up. The crowd got really large. There was actually, I think, a separate march and rally happening somewhere else in the city. So there was people all over San Francisco. And at some point, Joey Gibson and the rest of his crew decided to do like a little interview in a house or something. They had nowhere else to go, so they decided to hide inside and then stay in Pacifica, which is like south of San Francisco.
This is where Chatham had his shoes off and they had their like glorious press conference.
Yeah.
And then this is when they did this thing where they said like the moderate left needs to denounce, they said Trotskyites or some shit. I don't know. They're just like pulling words out of their ass. But, you know, essentially they were saying the radicals of the left need to be denounced. And this is something that like Gavin McGinnis has really echoed, that, you know, the quote unquote, the right has distanced itself from its extremists, but the left has not. And which is, it's just hilarious, because if you look at who actually showed up, you know, militia types, the hate preachers, Proud Boys, alt-right neo-Nazi trolls. I mean, that's who came out for their rally. So, that's their base. It's not like some fringe element that they have yet to somehow capture and push away.
Yeah, they're very much all inserted within each other's circles. They're not necessarily like a fringe outside element. But that narrative about like denouncing, you know, the violent left and Antifa is like kind of the main thing they were going for all weekend. I think they figured like, well, if we're not going to be able to do this anymore after Charlottesville, then, you know, the least we could do is sort of like create this overarching narrative that allows us to position the far left and anarchists and communists as the villains again.
Right. And that's like what's been picked up by the media.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the media criticizes us for playing into their hands, but really it's the media that's doing their job.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, so they did the little, you know, everything sucks and everyone's mean to us press conference, which was on Facebook Live, and then they kind of made their way back to Chrissy Fields.
Yeah, at that point there was different groups popping up all over the city, and different crews were ready to meet anyone, anywhere, really. I mean, the whole city was kind of on alert and on the lookout. And Joey Gibson and some other people did end up going to Chrissy Field after all. They weren't there for long. It sounds like Like, we got there a little bit later once people started getting chased out and leaving, but it sounds like they didn't have a good time there either. It was a bad weekend for them.
Yeah. And Joey Gibson online was saying stuff like, I'm sorry if you bought a plane ticket, basically just apologizing to people, like, if they came out. And again, I really want to stress, too, that these events that they had planned, as you said, like, months before, I mean, these were supposedly not going to be small events. They had hundreds and hundreds of people on the Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, we were expecting something more like what happened in Berkeley on April 15th. But Charlottesville really changed everything. People, there was, more moderate Trump supporters or mainstream conservatives that weren't willing to go out to these things anymore and get mixed up in it. And then on the other side, there was much more sort of center liberals that were willing to come out to support anti-fascists. So the dynamic totally changed.
Yeah, totally. Okay, and then the other big thing to point out is that night, the Red Elephants, which is kind of like an alt-right white nationalist live streaming service project media thing that, you know, live streamed the entire day, both days actually, they put out a tweet saying that there was going to be a tiki march in Sacramento, implying it was going to be like the Unite the Right tiki march. Obviously it was, you know, total bullshit, and they kind of like hashtagged it with stuff, hashtags that were opposing their demonstration, so it was kind of like baiting people. But also Juan Cadavid, or Johnny Benitez, whatever he wants to go by, posted up a picture of himself with a tiki torch, kind of like implying that he was going to go to this thing. And I don't know, again, that was hardly picked up by anyone in the media, although I know from talking to journalists that they were definitely aware about it. But again, it just shows like the intense connections between these groups and, like, you know, dog whistling or promoting this, you know, neo-Nazi tiki march that never happened. But, you know, these people are doing media work for Patriot Prayer.
Yeah, it seems like they were very confused and desperate all weekend. They had different strategies. At one point, they wanted to distance themselves completely from what happened in Charlottesville and say that they're not white supremacists, all that, you know, they have black speakers and trans and LGBTQ speakers. And then, you know, later that night when things, you know, sucked all day for them, they kind of doubled down on this, like, white nationalist appeal that just, like, didn't even work for them, right? Either.
It's really bizarre. And it's interesting, too, like, you brought up having, you know, all these different speakers of color, or, like, Amber Cummings, who's transgendered. I mean, they just wear this stuff like a shield. I mean, for people that supposedly hate identity politics, it's like their main thing is identity politics, and just using that to be like, you know, we're not, you know, white nationalists. I heard Will Johnson, who's an African American pro-Trump live streamer, was screaming like to the press, like, look at me, over and over again when they ask him about the politics of the event.
Yeah, and it's never, you know, no one ever actually explains their politics. It's just, look at me, or look at this person standing next to me, as if, you know, that means everything.
Right, but that never actually goes into, like, yeah, well, there's a regional representative of Identity Europa standing right next to you, so what about that?
Right.
Okay, well, going into Sunday, there was supposed to be a rally that was organized by essentially Kyle Chapman's camp, Kyle Chapman's camp. He was taken into custody on Friday for having a lead stick at the free speech rally on March 4th. It just came back to him. This again was obviously blowback for Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And so he was in custody, and then he was bailed out on Saturday. But basically his, like, second in command, Amber Cummings, was supposed to be the lead organizer. Apparently she filed a really shitty permit request. It was denied. And so there was no official permit, but the police set up barricades around the park they were supposed to be at. Oh, and also she told people, don't come to the rally, it's canceled, deleted the Facebook, and said, I will be there standing alone by myself against Marxism. The entire event was... Can you speak a little bit about just, I mean, it's almost like kind of like march against Sharia law, like they're just making stuff up, like stop Mothra from coming, destroying the city. Like, I mean, what is... Why do you think they chose to, like, have Stop Marxism in America?
Well, actually, I think that really points to, one, how much they misunderstand and don't know anything about the left, but also how much alt-right rhetoric has creeped into more mainstream right-wing circles. The alt-right constantly refers to this concept of cultural Marxism, which isn't actually a thing, but how they understand it is that Marxism is, you know, if you break it down, is all about critique. And their problem with it is that Marxism unrelentlessly critiques them, and basically they're just snowflakes with hurt feelings, and they don't want to be, you know, corrected or told that they're full of shit. So people have, like, bought that at this point, and they think, you know, Antifa and even liberals, you know, they're just like cultural Marxists that won't stop you know, suppressing the right and taking away their free speech and all this stuff.
Right.
So that's what they thought that they were protesting against, I think, that day.
What do you think was going on in the mind of Amber Cummings saying, like, it's canceled, don't come out? And they also said a bunch of weird stuff, like, we can't control who's coming, we can't stop the extremists or something like that. It really seemed like they were afraid that, like, you know, some skinheads were going to show up and they would just look really bad. But just if you can explain for people, like, what were they thinking? Like, you know, calling this and then telling people not to come, but only Amber was going to come. But then also on social media, like, alt-right people were saying, like, well, yeah, we're still coming. So,
yeah, I think it's essentially identical to Joey Gibson's strategy. I don't know how closely they were coordinating that, but I think maybe Amber was taking her cues from what Joey Gibson was doing, and that, you know, they thought that they could cancel their events and sort of put out to the press all these, like, fears and red baiting and, or, you know, red scare type of stuff. And just sort of try to reassert their position as victims post Charlottesville. But nobody was really buying it. But it was their only option at that point. I mean, even if they did have, you know, 300 to 400 people come, they still would have been outnumbered and dwarfed by whatever opposition came out. And it would have been bad for them either way. I think that was the only way for them to save face, really. And they couldn't even do that, yeah, right.
So Amber told people not to come. Some people did still show up, but, you know, by 11 in the morning, there was thousands of people in Berkeley. This is in the downtown area, centered, and the action was kind of centered around a park across from the police station and City Hall, Civic Center, Martin Luther King Jr. Park. Can you just tell us about, like, what happened essentially during the demonstration?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, maybe a few dozen right-wing people showed up, some a little bit more maybe mainstream conservative or Trump supporting people that don't quite buy into all the alt-right stuff. And it also went all the way to, like, you know, neo-Nazi types coming and showing up to the park. But it was only like a few dozen total, while there was just thousands and thousands of people opposing them, really coming from all directions. There was, it's hard to maybe describe just talking about it, but on all sides there was rallies planned. So there was rallies and marches that converged on the park from nearly every direction, and it was just like totally overwhelmed. And then at some point, you know, some news sources say it was about 100, but I think it was more like 300, about 300 strong Black Bloc showed up as a defense for the rest of the protesters.
Can you describe that? Because in the video and stuff, the Black Bloc marches in and there's a soundtrack behind it. So it looks like the Black Bloc is essentially kind of leading, or maybe leading's the wrong word, but the first kind of contingent in a larger procession. Like, it wasn't just them. It was a large, you know, group of different groups.
Yeah, I think it's important to stress the fact that they weren't like this outside group that hijacked anything. They weren't a group separated from any of the other organizations or groups that showed up. They were very much so integrated within the action as a whole. They were expected to be there, and they, as organizers from other groups said, the Black Bloc really stuck to agreements that were made publicly and played the part that they were willing to play to defend Berkeley and the rest of the protesters from the violent far right and also the police.
And let's talk a little bit, because I mean, you've kind of destroyed obviously that idea that some news media, and this is more like, you know, ABC Local 5 or whatever the fuck, has put out that the Black Bloc basically showed up and like ruined the day and everyone was nice and peaceful until the Black Bloc came and kicked puppies and stabbed your grandma and all that stuff, which you're saying, and we've reported as on It's Going Down, is obviously not what's happened. They were a large part of a bigger coalition, and you know, they had a role to play and they played that, so on and so forth. But the other big thing is that when the Black Bloc came to the park, it put up shields and banners facing the police, and the police were starting to aim projectile weapons at the crowd. So it kind of created a defensive perimeter around the larger crowd. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that the police, who always, like, you know, most people would think are there to protect people, would aim their weapons at anti-racist protesters, and while they facilitate what was going to end up being a neo-Nazi rally,
which didn't have a permit.
Yeah, which was denied a permit and totally denounced by almost everyone.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that they would have made that move to point their weapons at what everyone there saw as the good guys.
And not only that, but I mean, the other slice of this is that about a week before, I believe, the Berkeley City Council had passed a resolution giving special powers to the city manager, which essentially allowed them to declare any sort of public assembly that was non-permitted, that the police could basically break it up or arrest people or whatever. I mean, basically the same shit they always do, but just, you know, give themselves more of a legal precedence to do so. And supposedly this dissipates in December of this year, but the fear was that they were going to use that to basically declare a state of emergency and just arrest everybody.
Yeah. And what ended up happening was that they didn't do that. And the large block and everyone there in solidarity with them got the cops to not only put the weapons down, but actually leave the area, which then let the Black Bloc and essentially take over the park.
And this is where people were chanting, "Put the guns down," or something like that, or "Put the weapons down."
Yeah, I think it was "Put the guns down."
And they actually listened.
They did. Yeah, and I think that gets at what's really the scariest part about all of this for everyone. I mean, the violence that did end up happening that day was really small compared to what we've seen in Berkeley before and what's gone on elsewhere in the country. It was very, very, very contained and minimal. But I think that the most significant thing about that day was that so many people in the community were united. There was no one that really was willing to throw the Black Bloc under the bus, as people have done in the past. It was a very united and large community presence that decided to defy the mayor's orders to stay away from the park and the police's authority to police any unpermitted demonstration that may have contained weapons and masks. And the power and the authority of the city was completely irrelevant during that moment.
Well, before we get into kind of what happened next and the brawls and all that stuff, what were some of the things that you were hearing or that you have heard just from people that were outside of the Black Bloc or that were not anarchists or Antifa or whatever? What were they saying about the Black Bloc, or how was it received? Because I think that's the other thing that some media outlets have touched on, but most have not. You know, how were just, you know, people that were just standing around that were not dressed in black and not have a mask on, how were they receiving the anarchists and the anti-fascists in the Black Bloc? What were they saying? All that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just remembered one thing. I remember when the Black Bloc started getting their shields up in the front, a lot of people who weren't part of the block started clapping. And this reminded me of what happened during the Milo Yiannopoulos protest in February, when the Black Bloc showed up, the hundreds or thousands of students and other community people that were there cheered the Black Bloc before and even during and after what the Black Bloc ended up doing. And I saw the same thing this last weekend. And yeah, this time, you know, people didn't buy into the city's and the media's rhetoric about how, you know, people should separate themselves from people wearing black and from people that do violence. There was like, people were much more open and comfortable and willing to be around these people because there was a greater understanding. And again, the Black Bloc stuck to public agreements that
were made. Can you just describe what those were?
Well, I forget the specifics, but essentially what it came down to was that they were there as a defensive force. And, you know, of course, not everyone is going to agree, and some people don't understand what they saw as being defensive, but most of the thousands of people that were out there approved and understood all of the Bloc's tactics and actions as being in the best interest of the community that was gathered there.
Can you relay maybe any sort of things that you heard, or just kind of how, if people said anything, either positive or negative, to the presence of the Black Bloc? Because I remember watching Twitter and seeing like the reactions of different journalists, like shit's about to go down, or like holy fuck, oh my god, people in black, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah, I don't, you know, aside from the clapping and cheering that I saw towards the beginning of the Bloc's presence at the park, I didn't really hear good or bad things. And I think maybe that's kind of an interesting point in itself, that it was so expected and accepted that it was just a, you know, it was just as much a part of the protest as
the people,
you know,
on the soundtrack,
anyone else. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So the Black Bloc comes in, puts its shields up, people clap. There's a chant from the block and from the larger crowd of put the guns down. The police do so. And then did they like back up from the park, or how did people get to the point where they were kind of climbing over the barricades and then taking over this park?
Well, it seemed like at first that the cops were going to shoot tear gas at everyone. They were putting their masks on and kind of looked like they were getting ready to do that. At some point, they realized that this wasn't a good idea. They backed down and essentially, like, I think there was a couple people who were trying to get over the barricades and into the park, and the cops were stopping them. But it sort of seemed pointless because right behind this line of cops were hundreds and hundreds of protesters.
Already.
Anyway, I mean, it wasn't like they weren't really doing much. So I think they decided that there was no point anymore. They backed out and everyone just kind of took the part.
Right. And then there were reports that they were like they were shooting pepper balls at one point. And then I know some people were saying that there was tear gas deployed. Some people didn't understand that the colored smoke that anti-fascists have was just kind of, you know, decorative and cool looking. Some people were saying there's anti-fuck gas being released and stuff like that. But did you notice any sort of projectile weapons being shot by the police, or did that happen?
I thought I saw a picture somewhere on social media of something that they shot, but I didn't see that while I was out there. They did use tear gas, but that was much later when Joey Gibson had showed up and people chased him out of the park. Tear gas was used to kind of save him and separate the crowd. Okay.
And the anti-Antifa gas was, of course, colored smoke that was not harmful. It was just decorative and it looks cool.
Right.
Okay, so people have entered the park, and then, of course, we get to the point where altercations start to take place. And this is, you know, of course, what has led to so much, quote-unquote, backlash from the media. But can you just talk about, you know, how all that transpired? What did it look like? You know, what are some of the media narratives that are being pushed that aren't true?
Yeah, well, one thing, I guess, just to start off with is I don't understand why all these people showed up to a rally that they knew was canceled and that they knew they would be so outnumbered by. And if what they were saying was true about, you know, we have to cancel this because we're scared to go outside, then why did they go outside to a canceled rally?
Right.
Like, that just doesn't make sense.
Sorry to interject. I was just going to say, the other thing, too, is like at that point, you know, you have no moral high ground. You know, you're just a person going out to a public place just like all these other thousands of people. You know, your group does not have a permit. You know, you're just an individual, just like everybody else. So, I mean, this idea that somehow, you know, that their quote unquote event was somehow disrupted, or that, you know, people just attacked these, you know, peaceful, tranquil individuals, is just so silly, because it's like, you know, they didn't have a permit, their group told them not to come, and this other group that said they were going to be there for months showed up in the thousands.
Yeah, I mean, they were just straight up unwanted. They were not wanted in Berkeley or San Francisco. And I think, like, the fact that they showed up after having done all of that stuff just, like, really shows how much of an asshole all of these people are. Like, they are provocateurs. They are trying to, like, egg people on. And, you know, if that's what they want to do and they know what the response will be, I don't understand, like, the shock that people have to everything. Like, if you mess with people and you know, organize with white nationalists or are a white nationalist yourself and you go to, like, provoke people, like, what did you expect?
Yeah. Okay, well, just talk about you know, what happened.
You know, there was earlier in the day, there was, you know, a total, probably a couple dozen of these people. A lot of them got pushed out very nonviolently. And I think that shows that a lot of people had more restraint than the media likes to portray. I think they deserve credit for that. They probably could have done a lot more.
Yeah.
At some point, you know, there was people all around Berkeley sort of keeping an eye out for particular people. People knew that Joey Gibson and his crew were coming up the street towards the park. And they came in, you know, football gear and padding, and they knew what they were doing. They were looking to get into fights. They were in the park for maybe like not even 30 seconds, and driven out immediately and saved by the police. There was this other group of people who, it was like a couple of like a father and a son, who I think are also really like in the media as being, you know, showing how much of like overkill the violence from the Black Bloc was.
And this is the guy, one had like Trump shirt, and he was like Trump on a tank, and then his son had like the Pinochet was the fascist leader of Argentina.
Yeah, exactly. They had been in the park before, you know, all the video and pictures of them getting hit. They had been in the park pepper spraying random people.
And no one's actually drawn that connection, really, I think, besides Shane Bauer, perhaps. But, I mean, no one said, like, hey, lone people wearing a shirt with the fascist on it, pepper sprays, huge group, and then they get, you know, driven out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that has to do a lot with, like, the people that are reporting on this weren't even there. They have no idea what happened. They see like very sensational videos and pictures, and they think that they have the authority to kind of tell the story of what happened.
And then like the most viral one turned out to be this guy, Keith Campbell, who I guess is on Fox right now. But can we talk about his background, his story?
Yeah. Keith Campbell, everyone knew who he was. He's shown up to pretty much everything, all of these big rallies in February and March and April, not only in the Bay Area, but also in Southern California, in Portland. His intentions are to dox people, basically. He films and live streams as much as he can, hoping that, you know, 4chan or whatever other white supremacist community on the internet will pick up his images and his video and at some point bring some kind of violence, whether it's from the state or, you know, some right-wing group. But also he personally, like, stalks particular activists. He has shown up to left-wing events wearing, you know, an anarchist T-shirt, thinking that he's going to blend in, and doesn't. And his goal is, you know, he's been provoking people in real life and on social media for months now, you know, saying, like, people that, like, this, that one guy in Charlottesville, that the Black guy that got beat in the garage, you know, totally deserved it. And all this stuff, he's been saying, like, Antifa is going to get their ass kicked on April 27th. And, he was no stranger to people that were there. And he kind of got literally what he's been asking for.
Right. Months. I mean, literally saying, like, you know, we're going to kick your ass again. This is to, like, anti-fascists or any sort of protesters. Saying, we're going to kick your ass again, just like we did on the 15th. You know, come and get it, basically calling people pussies and things like that. So, but yeah.
I mean, he's like stalking one particular activist in the area, saying that he's going to show up to her house to, you know, do who knows what. And he's always talking about how he's like got knives and all this stuff. So, I mean, he's been identified as a dangerous person for a while, and he kind of just.
But now he's a kind, gentle man that was just walking home from getting groceries at the store and just happened to to be accosted by a mob of Antifa, right, or something like that.
Yeah, it was just an accident.
How apparently. Long did this period of altercations take place, or how long was that period exactly?
It was short. I mean, people were out there in downtown Berkeley for hours and hours, and like I personally only saw what happened when Joey Gibson came. But I was in the area the whole time and I didn't even see all these other violent, you know, actions and until later on the internet. Right. So like they were very, like not major at all. It was very easy to miss.
And then just the crowd kind of dissipated.
Yeah. I think once people thought, you know, they had won and there was, you know, no more to do, they kind of marched away together and dissipated. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about either the fallout or the, you know, the critical self-reflection that happened on the right in the wake of these demonstrations. I know that the Red Elephants, again, a white nationalist alt-right live streaming operation, they did a video like leaving the rally and they were saying stuff like, you know, this is why I'm sympathetic with the neo-Nazi that killed Heather Heyer. And, you know, we need to get militias and kill these people. I mean, I'm almost quoting verbatim. This is what they're saying. But also a lot of people are putting blame on Joey Gibson for basically leading, you know, a shit show of a rally. I'm just curious if you have any other insights as to like how people on the right viewed this.
Yeah, there, it seems like there's a lot of, you know, the fallout from the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville opened up a lot of cracks within the alt-right and all those connections that had been being made for months. But, that just continued here with a lot of people in the, on the West Coast in California and up where Joey Gibson is from. There's like a lot of distrust, and anger at the organizers, especially, for just not handling the weekend well at all. A lot of resentment for the cancellations. But also a lot of like, a lot of doubling down on this like violent, rhetoric and aspirations that, that drew out thousands to oppose them in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they're really, they have no idea what to do. Either they're not the violent people that everyone thinks they are and they shouldn't be protested or opposed, or, you know, when they lose, they have no other option but to just go right back to that and say, well, fuck it. Like,
we're going
to
kill you.
You know, this really, yeah, you know, that I understand now why, you know, someone would drive a car and do all this. Like, we really need to like form militias and all this stuff. It's like, okay, yeah, so you are those people.
Well, it's interesting because on alt-right.com, they published an article that basically, again, just attacked the police and said, see, they did it in Berkeley and San Francisco, just like they did it in Charlottesville. And also the people with Red Elephants, you know, really, they made a video about how there was a bunch of like police cars in one area and the police did nothing, which again is just, you know, total shit. You know, they protected these people. They brought them behind their lines. I mean, the police were out there on their side, you know, but they were just upset that, you know, basically the police in Berkeley did not, I don't know what they thought or wanted to happen, but just that it didn't go more their way on the end of the police, and also that they didn't get a permit. I mean, that was the main thing, you know, that there was just like not a massive police presence just protecting them. And it's very ironic, you know.
Yeah, I think even if they did get a permit, that things wouldn't have gone that much differently. I mean, they've never gotten a permit before over here in Berkeley. So, I mean, I think the thing is that, like, the cops don't really know what to do in these situations. And they think that they're doing, like, the best that they can or whatever, you know. I don't know what their strategy is. And then the right sort of doesn't understand why the cops are doing what they do. And then the cops get overwhelmed by the thousands of protesters out there and the 300 to 400 strong black bloc. And yeah, basically, like, they weren't in a position to do anything.
Well, let's talk a little bit about just kind of the media blowback. I mean, part of me, I was thinking about this today, and I think, you know, the media is almost more comfortable to kind of say this stuff now that we've had 2 weeks of just, as Richard Spencer calls it, the great shuttering. But, you know, massive deplatforming of the alt-right, you know, Daily Stormer has been kicked off, lots of websites shut down, a lot of people are switching over to Gab, Stormfront has been taken down. I mean, just things that before would have taken a lot of effort now are just, you know, sweeping across the board. They're being shut down. A lot of people have been fired, obviously. A lot of people have been exposed. Websites like rawstory.com are still constantly pumping out articles about the alt-right and about the Unite the Right demonstration. So there's still a lot of stuff that's, you know, been looking at this, and obviously Trump's comments have like pushed that forward. And also there was news like this weekend when these demonstrations happened also that like a Ku Klux Klan leader had shot into the crowd with a gun. So I mean, it's Charlottesville isn't going away as a story is what I'm saying. And in the wake of that, you know, all those big, on September 10th there was supposed to be Act for America marches, those were all canceled. There's not any big, you know, upcoming alt-right demonstration besides one I think that Joey Gibson is organizing on September 10th up in Portland. But, you know, it's definitely hurt them. And, they're beginning to write things on like altright.com that kind of signifies that they're going to go underground and do a bunch of crazy shit. But I mean, they're definitely not in a position where they have as much, public, social capital, so to speak. And it just seems like liberals are in a position now to kind of like in that moment be like, yeah, fuck the people that allowed this to happen, which is anti-fascist.
Yeah. And they're also taking credit for the victories. Like, I saw a lot of local reporting before this last weekend as Saturday and Sunday were approaching that credited the local politicians for sort of like making things hard for these people and totally erased the months and years of work that anti-fascists and anti-racists have been putting in to disrupt the organizing on the far right. Yeah, but I think for a while now, since Trump was elected, there's been this like push and pull with the Democrats and the people much farther to the left, where like at some times they're sort of okay with it, like Podolor. I know after like the Milo, this big New York Times article that wasn't perfect, but was kind of different for a lot of people to be like, oh wow, the New York Times is talking about anarchists and the Black Bloc. Right. Like,
well, it was more neutral.
Then they have these moments where they sort of, yeah, they've had more neutral moments, and then they decide like this isn't a moment where they can bring those people into the Democratic Party, or it doesn't actually serve their purpose, so they kind of go back again, and distance themselves.
Yeah. Well, definitely Charlottesville. I mean, we published something on IGD about how the Democratic Party was attempting to recuperate Charlottesville, but definitely that was a moment that they wanted to kind of use and feed off of. But, you know, they really want to draw that line, obviously, against anarchists and any sort of autonomous, anti-capitalist revolutionary force that's going to spring up. And I think with the media, I think there was a period after Charlottesville where they just kind of had to admit that the, you know, obviously the alt-right and fascism was a problem, and that, you know, people fighting it was, you know, perhaps legitimate, and they just kind of had to allow some of those voices in. But that's just turned around really quickly because, and again, it, you know, just because now it seems like people are so against it. So they're just, but I mean, at the same time, that doesn't mean that it's going to go away or that it's gone. you know, it's still very much there. I mean, all those people that came out to Unite the Right are still here in the U.S. It's not like they disappeared somehow.
Yeah, and they're not saying they're giving up either. I mean, this is not Charlottesville and this last weekend and what happened in Boston. This is not the end. It just, I think, marks a shift in what the alt-right has the opportunity to do. I mean, they're saying now that they're, you know, they need to rethink their strategies and all this stuff. They're not going away. They're going to come back differently. But for the Democrats, I mean, what other option do they have? Like, they're not going to say like, oh, wow, yeah, all these anarchists and communists won. You know, maybe we're irrelevant and you should join them.
Right, right. Yeah. Obviously, they're not going to say that.
Yeah.
Well, just last question. I mean, just looking at the alt-right, I mean, what do you think they're going to do? Like, what's their next move after Charlottesville? I mean, not that there is one single move for them, but what do you think will happen?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, I think these, like, free speech rallies are definitely going to slow down or stop altogether. I mean, for a while now, they've been happening almost every week somewhere in the country. Like, whether big or small, they've been happening for a while now. And at this point, I think they're realizing that the free speech excuse does not fly anymore. And that's going to end. But I think what they're going to try to do, it seems like they need to sort of, again, like reassert their position as victims or like morally superior to the left. So they've been really like focusing on this petition to, you know, declare Antifa a terrorist organization. And the mayor of Berkeley wants Antifa to be declared a gang. I think that's in their interest at this point, is like not to maybe advance their own cause, but find ways to like demonize the left so that they can come back in a position where we're weaker the next time.
Yeah. Which is also like a weird point where like the far right and the center just really intersect, because they both want to have that kind of like moral positioning and, I don't know, just, you know, being able to position themselves in opposition to some bad thing.
Yeah, but it's always the anti-fascists who are playing into the hands of the right.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, I think that's a really good point that you make, and something that we'll need to amplify is that, you know, it's just like the trope, like, I hate when people in the media are like, because you protest, that means the media gives them attention. It's like, no, motherfucker, it's like, you're in the media, you're the one writing the article. It's like, we're not giving them attention, you are. You know, we're trying to shut them down. You're the one writing the article and has the expose and the documentary behind the scenes. Yeah, it's crazy. But thanks for sharing.
Yeah, yeah. There's also like, you know, there was supposed to be this protest this morning in San Francisco of the alt-right saying they're going to shut down the Golden Gate Bridge until San Francisco declared Antifa a terrorist organization. But that was totally fake. The Facebook page event had 2 likes on it. No one was saying they were going on the Facebook event. Yet all these like local media outlets were like blowing up this event like crazy. Like they were actually doing the work to promote that event more so than the supposed organizers.
Right.
Of it. It's like ridiculous. Yeah.
Well, that'll blow back on them as well. You know, that's not going to last forever. But yeah, it's insane that, I mean, just so people are aware of what we're talking about, in San Francisco, some alt-right trolls on 4chan said they were going to block the Golden Gate Bridge until Antifa was declared a terrorist organization. And was there a Facebook page or no?
Yeah, someone made a Facebook page for it and then through that page made a Facebook event.
But there was nobody going to the event.
Yeah, there was like one left-wing person said they were interested just as a way to like sort of keep tabs on it. But no one said they were going. It was obviously fake from the start. No one cared.
Wow. And the media just ate it up because it's just...
Yeah, yeah. They're like, you know, oh, you know, traffic tomorrow morning might be really bad because the alt-right might be blocking the bridge.
Yeah, again, not a hearts and minds strategy. Exactly. Right. Wow, that's crazy. Well, anything else you want to add?
Not so much to what we talked about, but coming up in September, there's the, you know, Milo apparently is coming back to Berkeley with Ann Coulter and Steve Bannon. I would just urge people to keep an eye on that and come out to that.
And Milo still continues. The Mercer family, the billionaires, are so kind, and they continue to keep him afloat. He's no one really talks about him anymore. But what is his story besides getting money from billionaires? Does he actually have a functioning company? No, his book has sold like 3 copies in the UK, and that's like the last I've heard. What is going on with this fucking ass clown that is Milo Yiannopoulos?
I mean, no one really knows, I don't think. I mean, he's had a few like events that he's had like live streamed or had videos on the internet, and it's like the quality of the video and the sound is really bad, and there's like obviously paid actors and models there to support him, and it seems really pathetic. There's like videos of like paid trolls going into Barnes and Noble stores like complaining that they're not selling his book. But
that is so pathetic. That's so pathetic. Why would you film that? I want you to go in the store and complain that they're not selling my book because it's so shitty.
Yeah. Go harass the service worker at Barnes and Noble about why the corporate decision makers are not selling.
Probably because no one wants to fucking buy it. That's why. Jesus Christ. I mean, they're there to make money. I mean, they would sell anything. Wow, that's insane. So they're going to – this is the Berklee College Republicans that are going to bring Milo and Steve Bannon and Ann Coulter.
Yeah, apparently the Berklee College Republicans and with a lot more cooperation from the UC Berklee administration this time, they have a new chancellor that is really, really rolling out the red carpet basically for all these right-wing speakers. Yeah. And the college Republican group that has ties to Identity Europa. I say the war shouldn't stop until these player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock. I say the war shouldn't stop until these player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock. You'll never find a thug, it's bunch of niggas like us. Don't be so quick to test us, I'll be more than Mike Buss. I'ma have to talk to EZ through the Ouija so I can see. And maybe he can tell me why you hating on me, biting on me, why you want me to show a nigga leather face and knee. Don't fuck around, nigga, he's a real fucking pound, nigga. Motherfucker, rapping, how about fucking with me now, nigga? Niggas get your checks from your bras, get out. In your bras, sneak your keys from your niggas and ride. Everybody wanna party, even the niggas with a problem. Hey, nigga, we'll solve them, cause bitch, we'll squash them. Don't know me, fuck you and you got B. But you also got 2 clones, guys, and no more tea. See me rapping on your TV acting, and it's affecting when you see us in person. Think we gon' flex, or show you no action. Y'all for mine, got to show a nigga time to time. So I figure I'll slow down the rhyme, so they can understand I feel with so much anger and pain. And if I drop, then I'll explode like a fucking grenade, nigga. Fuck calm, time to ring the alarm. Break the niggas out of prison, killing all the guards. Power to the people, giving people the power to put it down in your city. And fuck them hillbillies, nigga, I can't stand up. Motherfucking popo, when we start killing these bitches and taking no more. Yeah, took the only clip that I claim. Although we all be on the banging, you can say I roll with a gang. And disenchant checkers in the make. So nigga, continue with the revenge. I say the war shouldn't stop until these player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock. Yeah, nigga, we heard about all of the murders over they did that time round. Flippin' the flow, they let it burn. With a surface of the police, they strong for the bar. Bitch, you fuckin' with all of the black, yeah, please. In the 1999, when you beat up in these, you're finna be no peace from release the beast. Hit 'em with the streets and get them on feet. Get a bit fit, you don't make the feet. Bitch, never retreat, nigga, lose your all, but you use your feet. And pick up my hand and nigga, yeah, yeah. Get it fucked, you're up. We're corrupt as a $4 fuck. Can we get fucked up and get out the county, nigga, get rowdy, duck in the back. Disappear here, in the island. We're pimp here, off a cabin. And you feel me, daddy, finally out of stuff like a man. And we do shit again. Look in the pattern and fuck the rest. I call a bitch. Meditation, nation, nowadays I got your passion.
sunshine. So why you hate me, stuck and play me away? Go on, be gone. The point of view was made with the sun. And why do they pop us?
I say the bullshit is stopping. Till it's clear, hating niggas. Body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock. I say the war shouldn't stop until these player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock.
How do you see me when you see me drinking on Hennessy and rape me? Look at my eyes, my shit is dreamy. Begging a Scotty, won't you bring me up? I broke your gadget, rip, disrupt your order, infantry. Y'all better expect annihilation, fucking around with an FCT. And I better be soldier, organizer, fun to love and just us. Army seat full of harmony and niggas and dust we trust. So nigga, I bust a bag up on me, nigga, no mercy, shit is critical. Killing you individual with a Ouija type ritual. I'm digging a dish for all of you popo who felt you get coming ready. Ain't no way to be safe, nigga, that's the Army Brigade. So listen up and hear what's spoken as I start this local must retaliate. Because we chosen open, showing the Lord devotion.
I say the bullshit is stopping till this player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock. I say the war shouldn't stop until these player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock.
Now when you're fucking with me, make sure you know what you're doing. Got nigga that know they rolling with me. If we're ready, you're weird. Don't dare, you dare, we fled. Got it, Wayne. Gotta make sure I'm free so when you need me, I can buck another day. It's a phone thing. Better ride, ride. Cause when you're fucking with me, you're gonna die, die. Don't be surprised. Don't want the presidents. Wanna run it all. Run all of it all. Fuck that dog. Fuck that dog. Nigga, the shooting stick. Nigga, don't put no gun if you ain't gonna speed. Click, clack, clack. Be the sound. These bullets and haters is wrong. We bugging them down. Trust in me and harmony. I find peace. It turning to bless my soul, Lord. And everybody that rides with me. It's from me to you. It's from me to you. Me to you. It's just our point of view. So I like la-dee-da-da-da, la-dee-da-da-da, so
I say the war shouldn't stop until these player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock. I say the war shouldn't stop until these player hating niggas body rock, body rock, body rock. Nigga, the war shouldn't stop until these motherfucking cops body rock, body rock, body rock.